Chapter 71. Vladimirskaya Oblast, Russia. Novot was the first to spot the helicopter. It was coming from the direction of Moscow, flying dangerously fast a couple hundred feet above the ground. 90 seconds later, two more just like it flashed overhead.
Go back, Oded.
What about our orders?
To hell with our orders, go back!
Time. Time was slipping away from them. It stole silently through the forest, birch tree to birch tree. Time was now their enemy. Gabriel knew he had to seize hold of it, and for that he needed Yvonne's help. Keep him talking, he thought. Bad things happen when Yvonne stops talking. For now, Yvonne was wordlessly leading the procession of death along a snowy forest path, one massive hand wrapped around Kiara's arm. Flanked by bodyguards, Gabriel, Mikhail, and Grigori followed. Keep him talking.
What caused the depressions in the forest, Yvonne?
Why are you so damn interested in those depressions?
They remind me of something.
I'm not surprised.
How did you find them? Satellites. They show up nicely from space. Very straight, very even.
They're old. But the men who dug them did a good job. They used the bulldozer. It's still here if you'd like to have a look. It stopped working years ago.
So how do you open up the earth now, Yvonne?
Same method, new machine. It's American.
Say what you want about Americans. They still make a damn good bulldozer.
What's in the pits, Yvonne?
You're a smart boy alone. You seem to know a bit about our history. You tell me.
I assume they are mass graves from the Great Terror.
Great Terror? This is a Western slur invented by Koba's enemies.
Koba was Stalin's party name. Koba was Yvonne's hero.
What would you call the systematic torture and murder of 750,000 people, Yvonne?
Yvonne appeared to give the matter serious consideration.
I believe I would call it the long overdue pruning of the forest. The party had been in power for nearly 20 years. There was a great deal of dead wood that needed to be cleared away. And you know what happens when wood is chopped, Alon.
Splinters must fall.
That's right, splinters must fall.
Yvonne translated a portion of the exchange for his Russian-speaking bodyguards. They laughed. Yvonne laughed, too.
Keep him talking.
How did this place work, Yvonne?
You'll find out in a minute or two.
When was it in operation, 36, 37?
Yvonne stopped walking. So did everyone else.
It was 37. The summer of 37, to be precise. It was the time of the Troikas.
Do you know about the Troikas, Alon?
Gabriel did. He paid the information out slowly, deliberately.
Stalin was getting annoyed at the slow pace of the killings. He wanted to speed things up, so he created a new way of putting the accused on trial. The Troikas. One party member, one NKVD officer, and a public prosecutor. It wasn't necessary for the accused to be present during his trial. Most were sentenced without ever knowing that they were even under investigation. Most trials lasted 10 minutes. Some less.
And appeals were not permitted.
Yvonne added with a smile.
They won't be permitted now, either.
He nodded to the pair of bodyguards who were holding Grigori upright. The procession began moving again.
Keep him talking. Bad things happen when Yvonne stops talking.
I suppose the killing took place inside the dacha.
That's why it has a cellar with a special room in it, a room with a drain in the center of the floor. And that's why the track is winding instead of straight.
Stalin's henchmen wouldn't have wanted the neighbors to know what was going on here.
And they never did. The condemned were always picked up after midnight and brought here in black cars. They were taken straight into the dacha and given a good beating to make them easy to handle.
Then it was down to the cellar. 7 grams of lead in the nape of the neck.
And then
they were thrown into carts and brought out here to the graves.
Who's buried out here, Yvonne?
By the summer of 37, most of the heavy cutting had already been done. Koba just had to clear away the brush.
The brush?
Mensheviks, anarchists, old Bolsheviks who'd been associated with Lenin. A few priests, kulaks, and aristocrats for good measure. Anyone Koba thought could possibly pose a threat was liquidated.
Then their families were liquidated too. There's a real revolutionary stew buried beneath these woods, Alon. They all sleep together. Some nights, you can almost hear them arguing about politics. And the best part is, no one even knows they are here. Because you bought the land after the fall of the Soviet Union, to make sure the dead stayed buried. Ivan stopped walking. Actually, I was asked to buy the land. By whom?
My father, of course.
Ivan had answered without hesitation, annoyed by Gabriel's inquiries at first. He now actually seemed to be enjoying the exchange. Gabriel reckoned it must be easy to unburden one's secrets to a man who would soon be dead. He tried to frame another question that would keep Ivan talking, but it wasn't necessary. Ivan resumed his lecture without further prompting. When the Soviet Union collapsed, it was a dangerous time for the KGB. There was talk about throwing open the archives, airing dirty laundry, naming names. The old guard was horrified. He didn't want the KGB dragged through the mud of history. But they had other motivations for keeping the secrets too. You see, Alon, they weren't planning to stay out of power for long. Even then, they were plotting their comeback. They succeeded, of course. The KGB, by another name, is once again running Russia. And you preside over the last mass grave of the Great Terror.
The last? Ha 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 ha! Hardly! You can't put a shovel in the soil of Russia without hitting bone.
But this one is quite large. Apparently, there are 70,000 souls buried beneath these trees.
70,000! If it ever became public...
His voice trailed off, as if he were momentarily at a loss for words. Let us say, it might cause considerable embarrassment inside the Kremlin.
Is that why the president is so willing to tolerate your activities?
He gets his cut. The Tsar takes a cut of everything.
How much did you have to pay him for the right to kidnap my wife?
Ivan made no response. Gabriel pressed him to see if he could provoke another outburst of anger.
How much, Ivan? 5 million? 10, 20?
Ivan wheeled around. I'm tired of your questions, Alon. Besides, we haven't much farther to go. Your unmarked grave awaits you. Gabriel looked beyond Kiara's shoulder and saw a mound of fresh earth, covered by a dusting of snow. He told her he loved her. Then he closed his eyes. He was hearing things again. Helicopters. Chapter 72. Vladimirskaya Oblast, Russia. Colonel Leonid Melchenko could finally see the property. Four frozen streams meeting in a frozen marsh. A small dacha with a hole blown in the front door. A line of people walking slowly through a birch forest. He opened the mic on his headset.
Do you see them?
The pilot's helmet moved up and down rapidly.
How close can you get? Edge of the marsh. That's at least 300 meters away.
That's as close as I can put this thing down, Colonel.
What about the alphas? Fast rope insertion right into the trees. Nobody dies. Yes, Colonel.
Nobody dies. Who was he kidding?
This was Russia.
Someone always died. 10 more paces through the snow. Then Ivan heard the helicopters too. He stopped, cocked his head dog-like, shot a glance at Rudenko, started walking again. Time. Precious time. Nabot's message flashed across the screens of the annex. Helicopters inbound. Carter covered his telephone and looked at Chemron.
The FSB team confirms a line of people walking into the trees. It looks as if they're alive, Harry.
They won't be for long.
When will those Alpha Group forces be on the ground?
90 seconds.
Chamron closed his eyes. 2 turns to the right. 2 turns to the left. The burial pit opened before them, a wound in the flesh of Mother Russia. The ashen sky wept snow as they filed slowly toward it, accompanied by the thumping of distant rotors. Big rotors, thought Gabriel. Big enough to make the forest shake. Big enough to make Ivan's men restless. Ivan, too. Suddenly he was shouting at Grigori in Russian, exhorting him to walk faster to his death. But Gabriel, in his thoughts, was pleading for Grigori to slow his pace,
to stumble, to do anything possible to allow the helicopter's time to arrive. Just then the first swept in at treetop level, leaving a temporary blizzard in its wake. Yvonne was briefly lost in the White House. When he reemerged, his face was contorted with rage. He shoved Grigori toward the edge of the pit and began screaming at his guards in Russian. Most were no longer paying attention. A few of his mutinous legion were watching the helicopter settling at the edge of the marshland. The others had their eyes on the western sky, where two more helicopters had appeared. Four bodyguards remained loyal to Yvonne. At his command, they placed the condemned in a line at the edge of the pit, heels against the edge, for Yvonne had decreed that all were to be shot in the face. Gabriel was placed at one end, Mikhail at the other, Kiara and Grigori in the center. At first, Grigori was positioned next to Gabriel, but apparently that wouldn't do. In a burst of rapid Russian, his gun flailing wildly, Yvonne ordered the guards to quickly move Grigori and place Kiara at Gabriel's side. As the exchange was being made, two more helicopters thundered in from the west. Unlike the first, they did not streak past, but hovered directly overhead. Ropes uncoiled from their bellies, and in an instant, black-suited special forces were descending rapidly through the trees. Gabriel heard the sound of weapons dropping into the snow, and saw arms raising in surrender. And he glimpsed two men in overcoats running awkwardly toward them through the trees. And he saw Oleg Rodenko trying desperately to remove the Makarov from Yvonne's grasp. But Yvonne would not relinquish it. Yvonne wanted his blood. Yvonne gave his security chief a single mighty shove in the chest that sent him tumbling into the snow. Then he pointed the Makarov directly into Gabriel's face. He did not pull the trigger. Instead, he smiled and said, "Enjoy watching your wife die alone." The Makarov moved to the right. Gabriel hurled himself toward Yvonne, but could not reach him before the gun exploded with a deafening roar. As he toppled face first into the snow, two Alpha Group men immediately leapt onto his back and pinned him to the frozen ground. For several agonizing seconds, he struggled to free himself, but the Russians refused to allow him to move or to lift his head. "My wife!" he shouted at them. "Did he kill my wife?" Whether they answered, he did not know. The gunshot had robbed him of the ability to hear. He was aware only of a titanic physical struggle taking place near his shoulder. Then a moment later, he glimpsed Yvonne being led away through the trees. Only then did the Russians help Gabriel to rise. Twisting his head quickly around, he saw Kiara weeping over a fallen body. It was Grigori. Gabriel dropped to his knees and tried to console her, but she seemed unaware of his presence.
"They never killed her!"
she was screaming.
"Irina is alive, Grigori! Irina is alive!"
Part 5. The Reckoning. Chapter 73. Jerusalem. In the days following the conclusion of the G8 summit in Moscow, three seemingly unconnected news stories broke in quick succession. The first concerns Russia's uncertain future. The second, its dark past. The last managed to touch upon both, and ultimately would prove to be the most controversial. But then that was to be expected, grumbled a few of the old hands at British intelligence, since the subject of the story was none other than Grigori Volgonov. The first story unfolded exactly 1 week after the summit, and had for its backdrop the Russian economy. More to the point, its all-important energy industry. Because it was good news, at least from Moscow's point of view, the Russian president chose to make the announcement himself. He did so in a Kremlin news conference, flanked by several of his most senior aides, all veterans of the KGB. In a terse statement, delivered with his trademark glare, the president announced that Viktor Orlov, the dissident former oligarch now residing in London, had finally been brought to heel. All of Orlov's shares in Rus Oil, the Siberian oil giant, were to be immediately placed under the control of Gazprom, Russia's state-owned oil and gas monopoly. In exchange, said the president, Russian authorities had agreed to drop all criminal charges against Orlov and withdraw their request for his extradition. In London, Downing Street hailed the Russian president's gesture as statesmanlike, while Russia hands at the foreign ministry and the policy institutes openly wondered whether a new wind might be blowing from the east. Viktor Orlov found such speculation hopelessly naive, but the reporters who attended his hastily called London news conference did walk away with the sense that Viktor was not long for the fight. His decision to surrender Rus Oil, he said, was based on a realistic assessment of the facts,
The Kremlin was now controlled by men who would stop at nothing to get what they wanted. When fighting such men, he conceded, victory was not possible, only death. Or perhaps something worse than death. Victor promised not to be silenced, then promptly announced he had nothing further to say. 2 days later, Victor Orlov was quietly awarded his first British passport during a small reception at 10 Downing Street. He was also granted a private tour of Buckingham Palace, led by the Queen herself. He took many photographs of Her Majesty's private apartments and gave them to his decorator. Delivery trucks were soon spotted in Cheyne Walk, and passers-by were sometimes able to catch a glimpse of Victor working in his study. Apparently, he had finally decided it was safe to throw open his curtains and enjoy his magnificent view of the Thames. The second story also originated in Moscow, but unlike the first, it seemed to leave the Russian president at a loss for words. It concerned a discovery in a birch forest in Vladimirskaya Oblast, several mass graves filled with victims of Stalin's Great Terror. Preliminary estimates placed the number of bodies at some 70,000 souls. The Russian president dismissed the find as of little significance and resisted calls for him to pay a visit. Such a gesture would have been politically tricky, since Stalin, dead for more than a half century, was still among the most popular figures in the country. He reluctantly agreed to order a review of KGB and NKVD archives and granted the Russian Orthodox Church permission to construct a small memorial at the site, subject to Kremlin approval, of course. But let's leave the breastfeeding to the Germans, he said during his one and only comment. After all, we must remember that Kova carried out these repressions to help prepare the country for the coming war against the fascists. All those present were chilled by the detached manner in which the president spoke of mass murder. Also by the fact he referred to Stalin by his old party, nom de guerre, Kova. The circumstances surrounding the discovery of the killing ground were never revealed, nor was the owner of the property ever identified. It is for his own protection, insisted a Kremlin spokesman. History can be a dangerous thing. The third story broke not in Moscow, but in the Russian city sometimes referred to as London. This too was a story of death, not the death of thousands, but of one. It seemed the body of Grigory Bogdanov, the FSB defector and very public dissident, had been discovered on a deserted Thames dock, the victim of an apparent suicide. Scotland Yard and the Home Office took shelter behind claims of national security and released scant details about the case. However, they did acknowledge that Grigory was a somewhat troubled soul who had not adjusted well to a life in exile. As evidence, they pointed out that he had been trying to rekindle his relationship with his former wife, though they neglected to mention that same former wife was by then living in the United Kingdom under a new name and government protection. Also revealed was the somewhat curious fact that Grigory had failed to appear recently for the finals of the Central London Chess Club Championship, a match he was expected to win easily. Simon Finch, Grigory's opponent, surfaced briefly in the press to defend his decision to accept the title by forfeit. He then used the exposure to publicize his latest cause, which was the abolition of landmines. Buckley and Hobbs, Grigory's publisher, announced that Olga Sukova, Grigory's friend and fellow dissident, had graciously agreed to complete Killer in the Kremlin. She appeared briefly at Grigory's burial in Highgate Cemetery, before being escorted away by several armed security men and whisked back into hiding. Many in the British press, including reporters who had dealt with Grigory, dismissed the government's claim of suicide as hogwash. Without any other facts, however, they were left only to speculate, which they did without hesitation. Clearly, they said, Grigory had enemies in Moscow who wished him dead, and clearly, they insisted, one of those enemies must have killed him. The Financial Times pointed out that Grigory was quite close to Victor Orlov and suggested the defector's death might somehow be tied to the Ruse Oil affair. For his part, Victor referred to his dead countryman as a true Russian patriot and established a freedom fund in his name. And there the story died, at least as far as the mainstream press was concerned. But on the internet and in some of the more sensational scandal sheets, it would continue to generate copy for weeks. The wonderful thing about conspiracies is that a clever reporter can usually find a way to link any two events, no matter how disparate. But none of the reporters who investigated Grigory's mysterious death ever attempted to link it to the newly discovered mass graves in Vladimirskaya Oblast. Nor did they posit a connection between the Russian defector
and a heartbroken couple, who by then had taken refuge in a quiet little apartment on Narcus Street in Jerusalem. The names Gabriel Alon and Chiara Zoli were not a factor in the story, and they never would be. They had recovered from operational trauma before, but never at the same time, and never from wounds so deep. Their physical injuries healed quickly. The others refused to mend. They huddled behind locked doors, watched over by men with guns. Unable to tolerate more than a few seconds of separation, they followed each other from room to room. Their lovemaking was ravenous, as if each encounter might be the last, and rare was the moment they were not touching. Their sleep was torn by nightmares. They dreamed of watching each other die. They dreamed of the cell beneath the dacha in the woods. They dreamed of the thousands who were murdered there and the thousands who lay beneath the birch trees in graves with no markers. And of course, they dreamed of Yvonne. Indeed, it was Yvonne whom Gabriel saw most. Yvonne roamed Gabriel's subconscious at all hours, dressed in his fine English clothing, carrying his Makarov pistol. Sometimes he was accompanied by Yekaterina and his bodyguards. Usually he was alone. Always he was pointing his gun in Gabriel's face. "Enjoy watching your wife die, Alon." Chiara was not eager to speak of her ordeal, and Gabriel did not press her. As the child of a woman who had survived the horrors of the Birkenau death camp, he knew Chiara was suffering an acute form of guilt, survivor's guilt, which is its own special kind of hell. Chiara had lived, and Grigori had died, and he had died because he had stepped in front of a bullet meant for her. This was the image Chiara saw most in her dreams. Grigori, battered and barely able to move, summoning the strength to place himself in front of Yvonne's gun. Chiara had been baptized in Grigori's blood, and she was alive because of Grigori's sacrifice. The rest of it came out in bits and pieces, and sometimes at the oddest moments. Over dinner one evening, she described in detail for Gabriel the moment of her capture and the deaths of Lior and Lotti. 2 days later, while doing the dishes, she recounted what it was like to spend all those hours in the dark, and how, once each day, just for a few moments, the sun would set fire to the snowbank outside the tiny window. And finally, while folding laundry one afternoon, she tearfully confessed that she had lied to Gabriel about the pregnancy. She was 8 weeks gone at the time of the abduction, and lost the child in Yvonne's cell.
"It was the drugs," she explained. "They killed my child. They killed your child."
"Why didn't you tell me the truth? I would never have gone after Grigori."
"I was afraid you would be mad at me. For what? For getting pregnant?"
Gabriel collapsed into Chiara's lap, tears flowing down his face. They were tears of guilt, but also tears of rage. Though Yvonne did not know it, he had managed to kill Gabriel's child. His unborn child, but his child nonetheless.
"Who gave you the shots?" he asked.
"It was the woman. I see her death every night. It's the one memory I don't run from."
She wiped away his tears.
"I need you to make me 3 promises, Gabriel."
"Anything."
"Promise me we'll have a baby."
"I promise."
"Promise me we'll never be apart."
"Never."
"And promise me you'll kill them all."
The next day, these two human wrecks presented themselves at King Saul Boulevard. Along with Mikhail, they were subjected to rigorous physical and psychological evaluations. Uzi Nebot reviewed the results that evening. Afterward, he telephoned Shemron at his home in Tiberias.
"How bad?"
Shemron asked.
"Very."
"When will he be ready to work again?"
"It's going to be a while."
"How long, Uzi?"
"Maybe never."
"And Mikhail?"
"He's a mess, Ari.
They're all a mess."
Shemron fell silent.
"The worst thing we can do is let him sit around. He needs to get back on the horse."
"I take it you have an idea."
"How's the interrogation of Petrov coming along?"
"He's putting up a good fight."
"Go down to the Negev, Uzi. Light a fire under the interrogators."
"What do you want?"
"I want the names. All of them."
Chapter 74 Jerusalem. By then it was late March. The cold winter rains had come and gone, and the spring weather was warm and fine. At the suggestion of the doctors, they tried to get out of the apartment at least once a day. They reveled in the mundane, a trip to the bustling Makana Yehuda market, a stroll through the narrow streets of the old city, a quiet lunch in one of their favorite restaurants. At Shemlon's insistence, they were accompanied always by a pair of bodyguards, young boys with cropped hair and sunglasses who reminded them both too much of Lior and Moti. Chiara said she wanted to visit the memorial north of Tel Aviv. Seeing the bodyguards' names engraved in stone left her so distraught, Gabriel had to practically carry her back to the car. 2 days later, on the Mount of Olives, it was his turn to collapse in grief. Lior and Moti had been buried only a few yards from his son. Gabriel felt an unusually strong desire to spend time with Leah, and Chiara, unable to bear his absence, had no choice but to go with him. They would sit with Leah for hours in the garden of the hospital and listen patiently while she wandered through time, now in the present, now in the past. With each visit, she grew more comfortable in Chiara's company, and in moments of lucidity, the two women compared notes on what it was like to live with Gabriel alone. They talked about his idiosyncrasies and his mood swings, and his need for absolute silence while he was working. And when they were feeling generous, they talked about his incredible gifts. Then the light would go out in Leah's eyes, and she would return once more to her own private hell. And sometimes Gabriel and Chiara would return to theirs. Leah's doctor seemed to sense something was amiss. During a visit in early April, he pulled Gabriel and Chiara aside and quietly asked whether they needed professional help. "You both look as if you haven't slept in weeks."
"We haven't," said Gabriel.
"Do you want to talk to someone?"
"We're not allowed."
"Trouble at work?"
"Something like that."
"Can I give you something to help you sleep?"
"We have a pharmacy in our medicine cabinet."
"I don't want to see you back here for at least a week." "Take a trip, get some sun, you look like ghosts."
The next morning, shadowed by bodyguards, they drove to Eilat. For 3 days they managed not to speak about Russia, or Ivan, or Grigori, or the birch forest outside Moscow. They spent their time sunning themselves on the beach or snorkeling amid the coral reefs of the Red Sea. They ate too much food, drank too much wine, and made love until they were overcome by exhaustion. On their last night, they talked about the future, about the promise Gabriel had made to leave the office, and about where they might live. For the moment, they had no choice but to remain in Israel. To leave the country and the protective cocoon of the office was not possible so long as Ivan was still walking the face of the earth.
"And if he wasn't?"
asked Chiara.
"We can live wherever we like.
Within reason, of course."
"Then I suppose you'll just have to kill him."
They left Eilat the next morning and set out for Jerusalem. While crossing the Negev, Gabriel decided quite spontaneously to make a brief detour near Beersheba. His destination was a prison and interrogation center, located in the center of a restricted military zone. It housed only a handful of inmates, the so-called worst of the worst. Included in this select group was prisoner 6754, also known as Anton Petrov, the man Ivan had hired to kidnap Grigori and Chiara. The commander of the facility arranged for Petrov to be brought to the exercise yard, so Gabriel and Chiara could see him. He wore a blue and white tracksuit. His muscle was gone, along with most of his hair. He walked with a heavy limp.
"Too bad you didn't kill him,"
Chiara said.
"Don't think it didn't cross my mind."
"How long will we keep him?"
"As long as we need to."
"And then?"
"The Americans would like a word with him."
"Someone needs to make sure he has an accident."
"We'll see."
It was dark when they arrived in Narkis Street. Gabriel could tell by the abundance of bodyguards they had a visitor waiting upstairs in the apartment. Uzi Nabot was seated in the living room. He had a dossier. He had names. 11 names. All former KGB. All living well in Western Europe on Ivan's money. Nabot left the folder with Gabriel and said he would wait to hear from him. Gabriel allowed Chiara to make the decision.
"Kill them all,"
she said.
"It's going to take time."
"Take as much time as you need."
"You won't be able to come."
"I know."
You'll go to Tiberias. Gila will look after you.
They convened the next morning in room 456C of King Saul Boulevard. Yakov and Yossi, Hina and Ramona, Oded and Mordecai, Mikhail and Eli Levan. Gabriel arrived last and tacked 11 photographs to the bulletin board at the front of the room. 11 photographs of 11 Russians. 11 Russians who would not survive the summer. The meeting did not take long. The order of death was established. The assignments were made. Travel saw to the flights. Identity to the passports and visas. Housekeeping opened many doors. Banking gave them a blank check. They left Tel Aviv in waves, traveled in pairs, and reconvened 2 weeks later in Barcelona. There, on a quiet street in the Gothic Quarter, Gabriel and Mikhail killed the man who had been walking behind Grigori on Harrow Road the evening of his abduction. For his sins, he was shot at close range with .22 caliber Berettas. As he lay dying in the gutter, Gabriel whispered two words into his ear.
For Grigori.
A week later, in the Bairro Alto of Lisbon, he whispered the same two words to the woman who had been walking toward Grigori, the woman who had carried no umbrella and had been hatless in the rain. 2 weeks after that, in Biarritz, it was the turn of her partner, the man who had been walking next to her on Westbourne Terrace Road Bridge. He heard the two words while taking a midnight stroll along La Grande Plage. They were spoken to his back. When he turned, he saw Gabriel and Mikhail, arms extended, guns in their hands.
For Grigori.
After that, news of the killings began to circulate among those still to die. To prevent the survivors from fleeing to Russia, the authors planted false stories that it was Ivan, not the Israelis, who was responsible. Ivan had launched a great terror, according to the rumors. Ivan was pruning the forest. Anyone foolish enough to set foot in Russia would be killed the Russian way, with great pain and extreme violence. And so the guilty stayed in the West, close to ground, below radar, or so they thought. But one by one they were targeted, and one by one they died. The driver of the Mercedes that took Irina to her reunion with Grigori was killed in Amsterdam in the arms of a prostitute. The driver of the van that carried Grigori on the first leg of his journey back to Russia was killed while leaving a pub in Copenhagen. The two flunkies sent to kill Olga Sukova in Oxford were next. One died in Munich, the other in Prague. It was then Sergei Korovin made a frantic attempt to intervene.
The SVR and FSB are getting itchy, Korovin told Chamron. If this continues, who knows where it might lead?
In a page taken from Ivan's playbook, Chamron professed ignorance. Then he warned Korovin that the Russian services had better watch their step, otherwise they were next. By that evening, office stations across Europe detected a notable increase in security around Russian embassies and known Russian intelligence officers. It was unnecessary, of course. Gabriel and his team had no interest in targeting the innocent, only the guilty. At that point, just four names remained. Four operatives who had carried out the abduction of Chiara in Umbria. Four operatives who had office blood on their hands. They knew they were being stalked and tried not to remain in one place long. Fear made them sloppy. Fear made them easy pickings. They were killed in a series of lightning strike operations. Warsaw, Budapest, Athens, Istanbul. While dying, they heard four words instead of two.
For Lior and Motti.
By then it was nearly August. It was time to go home again. Chapter 75. Tiberias, Israel. But what of Ivan? For many weeks after the nightmare in the birch forest outside Moscow, he stayed out of sight. There were rumors he had been arrested, rumors he had fled the country, rumors even that he had been taken away by the FSB and killed. They were false, of course. Ivan was just observing another great Russian tradition, the tradition of internal exile. For Ivan, it was not marked by back-breaking labor or starvation rations. Ivan's gulag was his fortress-like mansion in Zhukovka, the secret city of the oligarchs east of Moscow. And he had Yekaterina to soothe his wounds. Though Ivan's name was never publicly linked to the killing site in Vladimirskaya Oblast, its exposure seemed to do harm to his standing inside the Kremlin. In certain circles, much was made of the fact that Ivan's development firm lost out on an important construction project, and that his nightclub was suddenly out of fashion with the Siloviki and the other Moscow well-connected, and that his luxury car dealership saw a sudden sharp decrease in sales. These were false readings, though, more symptomatic of Russia's troubled economy than any real decline in Ivan's fortunes. What's more, his arms dealings continued apace, weapons sales being one of the few bright spots in an otherwise bleak global financial climate. Indeed, British, American, and French intelligence all noticed a sharp spike in the number of Kharkov-owned aircraft touching down on isolated landing strips from the Middle East to Africa and beyond. And the Russian president continued to take his cut. The Tsar, as Ivan liked to say, always took his cut. NSA surveillance revealed that Ivan was aware of the systematic liquidation of Anton Petrov's operatives, and that it troubled him not at all. In Ivan's mind, they had betrayed him, and thus deserved the fate that befell them. In fact, throughout that long summer of retribution, he seemed obsessed by only two questions. Had his children been aboard the American jet that landed in Kornakovo, and had they truly composed the letter of hatred handed to him by the pilot? The children and their mother knew the answer, of course, along with the American president and a handful of his most senior officials. So, too, did the small band of Israeli intelligence officers who convened at sunset on the first Friday of August north of the ancient city of Tiberias. The occasion was Shabbat. The setting was Shemron's honey-colored villa overlooking the Sea of Galilee. The entire team was present, along with Sarah Bancroft, who had decided to spend her August holiday with Mikhail in Israel. There were spouses Gabriel had never met, and children he had only seen in photographs. The presence of so many children was difficult for Kiara, especially when she saw their faces lit by the glow of the Shabbat candles. As Gila recited the blessing, Kiara took Gabriel's hand and held it tightly. Gabriel kissed her cheek and heard again the words she had spoken to him in Umbria.
We mourn the dead and keep them in our hearts, but we live our lives.
The summer spent by the lake had done wonders for Kiara's appearance. Her skin was deeply tanned, and her riotous dark hair was aglow with gold and auburn highlights. She smiled easily throughout the meal, and even burst into laughter when Bella scolded Uzi for taking a second portion of Gila's famous chicken with Moroccan spice. Watching her, Gabriel could almost imagine none of it had actually happened, that it had only been a dream from which they had both finally awakened. It wasn't true, of course, and no amount of time would ever fully heal the wounds Ivan had inflicted. Kiara was like a newly restored painting, retouched and shimmering with a fresh coat of varnish, but still damaged. She would have to be handled with great care. Gabriel had feared the gathering would be an occasion to relive the dreadful details of the affair, but it was mentioned only once when Shemron spoke about the importance of what they had achieved. As Jews, they all had relatives whose earthly remains were turned to smoke by the crematoria or were buried in mass graves in the Baltics or the Ukraine. Their memories were kept by commemorative flames and by the index cards stored in the Hall of Names at Yad Vashem, but there were no graves to visit, no headstones upon which to shed tears. By their actions in Russia, Gabriel's team had given such a place to the relatives of the 70,000 murdered at the killing ground in Vladimirskaya Oblast. They had paid a terrible price, and Grigory had not survived, but with their sacrifice they had given a kind of justice, perhaps even peace, to 70,000 restless souls. For the remainder of the meal, Shemron regaled them with stories of the past. He was never happier than when surrounded by his family and friends, and his good mood seemed to soften the deep cracks and fissures in his aged face. But there was sadness there, too. The operation had been traumatic for all of them, but in many ways it had been hardest on Shemron. With his cool, creative thinking, he had saved all their lives. But for more than an hour that terrible morning, he had feared that three officers, two of whom he loved as children, were about to suffer a horrible death. There was an emotional price to be paid for an operation like that, and Shemron paid it, later that evening, when he invited Gabriel to join him on the terrace for a private chat. They sat together on the spot where Gabriel and Kiara were married, Shemron smoking quietly, Gabriel gazing at the blue-black sky above the Golan.
Your wife looks radiant this evening, almost like new.
Looks can be deceiving, Ari, but she does look wonderful. I suppose I have Gila to thank. She obviously took good care of her while I was gone.
Gila is good at putting people back together again. even when she's not sure how they ended up broken in the first place. I must say we enjoyed having Kiara for the summer. If only my own children would come more often.
Maybe they would if you didn't smoke so much.
Shamrone took a final pull at his cigarette and crushed it out slowly.
You actually looked as if you were enjoying yourself too. Or were you just deceiving me?
It was a wonderful evening, Ari. In fact, it was exactly what we all needed.
Your team adores you, Gabriel. They would do anything for you.
They have, Ari. Just ask Mikhail.
Do you think he's actually going to marry this American girl?
Her name is Sarah. Surely, as a Jew from Tiberias, you should have no trouble remembering that name.
Answer my question.
He'd be a fool not to marry her. She's a remarkable woman.
But she's not Jewish.
She might as well be.
Do you think the CIA will let her stay on if she marries one of us?
If they don't, you should hire her. If it weren't for Sarah, Anton Petrov might have killed Uzi in Zurich. Shamrone made no response other than to light another cigarette. How is he? Gabriel asked.
Petrov!
Shamrone pulled his lips into an indifferent frown.
Not so good.
What's wrong?
Apparently he managed to escape the detention and interrogation facility. A group of Bedouin found his body out in the Negev, about 50 miles south of Beersheba. The vultures had got to him by then. I hear it wasn't pretty.
I'm sorry I didn't get to have a final word with him.
Don't be. While you were in Europe, we were able to wring one more confession out of him. He admitted to killing those two journalists from Moskovskaya Gazeta last year on Ivan's orders. But given the rather sensitive circumstances of his admission, we are in no position to forward the information to the French and Italian authorities. For now, both cases will remain officially unsolved.
What did you do with the 5 million euros Petrov left in Becker and Poole?
We made him sign it over to Conrad Becker to cover the costs of the mess you made in his bank. He sends his best, by the way, but he would be most grateful if you did your private banking elsewhere.
Were you forced to clean up any other messes?
Not really. Our disinformation campaign managed to deflect all suspicion from us onto Ivan. Besides, these were not exactly fine, upstanding citizens whom you killed. They were former KGB hoods who traded in murder, kidnapping, and extortion. As far as the European police and security services are concerned, we did them a favor.
Shimon looked at Gabriel for a moment in silence.
Did it help?
What?
Killing them.
Gabriel gazed out at the black waters of the lake. I did terrible things in order to get Kiara back, Ari. I did things I never want to do again.
But?
Yes, it did help.
11,
Shamrone said.
Ironic, don't you think?
How so?
Your first assignment came about because Black September killed 11 Israelis in Munich. And for your final assignment, you and Mikhail killed 11 Russians who were responsible for Kiara's abduction and Grigory Bogdanov's death.
A heavy silence settled between them, broken only by the sound of laughter at the dinner table.
My final assignment? I thought you and the Prime Minister had decided it was my time to take over the office.
Have you seen your fitness reports?
Shamrone shook his head slowly.
You're in no condition to take on the responsibility of running the office now. Not when we have a confrontation with the Iranians looming, and not when your wife needs your attention.
What are you saying, Ari?
I'm saying that you are released from the promise you made in Paris. I'm telling you that you're fired, Gabriel. You have a new mission now. Get your wife pregnant again as quickly as possible. You're not so young, my son. You need to have another child quickly.
Are you sure, Ari? Are you really prepared to let me go?
I'm sure we'll always find something for you to do, but it's not going to be sitting behind the desk in the director's suite. We're going to inflict that chore on someone else.
Do you have a candidate in mind?
Actually, we've already settled on one. It's going to be announced next month when Amos steps down.
Who is it?
Me.
said Uzi Nabot. Gabriel turned and saw Nabot standing on the terrace, his heavy arms folded across his chest. In the half-light, he looked shockingly like Shamron in his youth. Brilliant choice, don't you think?
I'm speechless.
For once. Nabot came forward and placed his hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
We have a wonderful system, you and I. You turn a job down and they give it to me.
But the right man got the job in both cases, Uzi.
I would have been a terrible director.
Mazel tov.
Do you mean that, Gabriel?
The office is going to be in good hands for years to come. Gabriel cocked his head toward Shamron.
Now, if we can just get the old man to let go of the bicycle seat.
Shamron grimaced.
Let's not get carried away. But let us also be clear about one thing. Uzi is not going to be my pawn. He'll be his own man. But obviously, I'll always be here to offer advice, whether he wants it or not. Be careful, my son. Otherwise, I'll advise him to deal with you harshly.
Nabot walked over and leaned against the balustrade.
What are we going to do with him, Ari?
In my opinion, he should be locked in the room with his wife and kept there until she is pregnant again.
Done.
Nabot looked at Gabriel.
It's an order. And you're not going to disobey another one of my orders, are you, Gabriel?
No, sir.
So, what are you going to do with all this spare time?
Rest.
After that,
Gabriel gave a noncommittal shrug. To be honest, I haven't a clue.
Just don't get any ideas about leaving the country, Shamron said. For the time being, your address is number 16 Narki Street.
I need to work.
So we'll find you some paintings to clean.
The paintings are in Europe.
You can't go to Europe, Shamron said. Not yet.
When?
When we've dealt with Ivan. Then you can leave.
Chapter 76 Jerusalem. Gabriel and Chiara made a determined effort to follow Nabot's order to the letter. They found little reason to leave their apartment. A furnace-like August heat had settled over Jerusalem, and the daylight hours were intolerably hot. They ventured out only after dark, and even then only briefly. For the first time in many years, Gabriel felt a strong desire to produce original work. His subject matter, of course, was Chiara. In just 3 days, he painted a stunning nude that, when finished, he propped against the wall at the foot of their bed. Sometimes, when the room was in darkness and he was intoxicated with Chiara's kisses, it was almost possible to confuse canvas with reality. It was during one such hallucination that the bedside telephone rang quite unexpectedly. With Chiara astride his hips, he was tempted not to answer. Reluctantly, he brought the receiver to his ear.
"We need to talk," said Adrian Carter.
"And listening?" "Not over the phone."
"Where?"
They met for breakfast 2 days later on the terrace of the King David Hotel. When Gabriel arrived, he found Carter wearing a wrinkled poplin suit and reading the International Herald Tribune. It had been many months since they had seen each other. Indeed, their last encounter had occurred at Shannon Airport in Ireland, the morning after the G8 summit. Under the agreement reached with the Russian president, Gabriel, Chiara, Mikhail, and Irina Bogdanova had been allowed to leave Moscow the same way Gabriel had arrived, surrounded by Secret Service agents, aboard the so-called car plane. They had disembarked during a refueling stop and had gone their separate ways. Irina had accompanied Graham Seymour to Britain, while Gabriel, Chiara, and Mikhail had flown home to Israel with Shamron. Carter had been so overcome by emotion that morning that he had neglected to ask Gabriel for the official American passport he had used to enter Russia. He did so now, a moment after retaking his seat. Gabriel tossed it onto the table, emblem down.
"I hope you didn't use this during a little European holiday this summer."
"I haven't left Israel since I got back from Russia."
"Nice try, Gabriel, but we have it on very good authority that you and your team spent the summer killing Anton Petrov's friends and associates. And you did a damn good job of it."
"It wasn't us, Adrian.
It was Ivan. My European station chiefs heard those rumors, too."
Carter opened the passport and began leafing through the pages.
"Don't worry, Adrian. You won't find any new visas in there. I wouldn't do that to you or the president. My wife is alive because of you, and I'll never be able to repay you. I believe the balance of our account is still weighted heavily in your favor. Carter sipped his coffee and changed the subject. We hear there's about to be a change at the helm of King Saul Boulevard. Needless to say, Langley is pleased by the choice. I've always been fond of Uzi. But, obviously, we were hoping the next chief would be you. We understand why that's not going to be possible, and we wholeheartedly support your decision. I can't tell you how relieved I am to know I have the support of Langley, Adrian. Do try to control that caustic Israeli wit of yours. Carter dabbed his lips with his napkin. Have you given any thought to your future plans? For the moment, Kiara and I will have to stay here. Gabriel nodded toward the pair of bodyguards seated two tables away. Protected by children with guns. You could come to America. Elena says you're welcome any time. In fact, she says she'd be willing to build a house for you and Kiara on the estate. If I were in your shoes, I'd be tempted to take her up on the offer. That's because you grew up in New England, and you're used to the winters. I'm from the Valley of Jezreel. She's not joking, Gabriel. Please, thank Elena, and tell her I do appreciate the offer, but I can't accept it. Her children are going to be very disappointed. Carter handed Gabriel an envelope. They wrote you a letter. Actually, it's addressed to you and Kiara. What is it? A letter of apology. They want you to know how sorry they are for what their father did. Gabriel removed the letter and read it in silence. It's beautiful, Adrian. But tell the children they have no need to feel guilty about their father's actions. Besides, we would never have been able to get Kiara back without their help. Apparently, they put on quite a performance at Andrews. Fielding says it was one for the books. The Russian ambassador never suspected a thing. Gabriel returned the letter to the envelope and smiled. Though the Russian ambassador did not realize it, he had been a bit player in an elaborate deception. It was true that Anna and Nikolai had boarded the U.S. Air Force C-32 at Andrews, but at Gabriel's insistence, they had been kept far from Russian airspace. Indeed, within seconds after passing through the cabin door, they walked straight into the hold of a hydraulic catering vehicle, where Sarah Bancroft was waiting. 10 minutes after the ambassador departed, they joined their mother aboard the Gulfstream and returned to the Adirondacks. Only the note was genuine. It had been written by the children at Andrews and handed over to the pilot. According to Elena, they had meant every word of it. My director bumped into the Russian ambassador at a White House reception a couple of months back. He's still fuming about what happened. Apparently, he lives in fear of Ivan's wrath. He spends as little time in Russia as possible. Gabriel slipped the letter into his shirt pocket. Surely Carter hadn't come all the way to Jerusalem to recover a passport and deliver a letter. But he seemed in no hurry to get around to the real reason for his visit. He was now reading his newspaper. He folded it in quarters and handed it across to Gabriel. You see this? He asked, tapping a headline. It was a story about the new memorial at the killing ground in Vladimirskaya Oblast. Though understated and small, it had already attracted tens of thousands of visitors, much to the chagrin of the Kremlin. Many of the visitors were relatives of those killed there, but most were ordinary Russians who came to see something of their dark past. Since the memorial's opening, Stalin had seen a precipitous slide in his standing. So too had the current regime. Indeed, more and more Russians were beginning to voice their discontent. The reporter for the Herald Tribune wondered whether Russians might be so willing to accept an authoritarian future if they spoke more openly about their totalitarian past. Gabriel wasn't so sure. He remembered something Olga Sukova had once said while walking through Novodevichy Cemetery. Russians had never known true democracy, and in all likelihood they never would. It says here the Russian president still hasn't paid a visit. He's a very busy man, said Carter. Do you think he's regretting the decision to make it public? I'm afraid he had no choice. We agreed to keep everything about the affair quiet and to cover up Grigory's death with that ridiculous story about suicide. But the graves weren't part of the deal. In fact, we made it clear to the Kremlin that if they didn't tell the Russian people the truth, we would do it for them. Gabriel folded the newspaper and tried to return it to Carter. Look at the story below it. The subject was a new round of bloodletting in the Congo that had left more than 100,000 people dead. It was accompanied by a photo of a distraught mother holding the body of her dead child. And guess who's helping to fan the flames? Carter asked.
Yvonne.
Carter nodded his head. He put 2 plane loads of weapons on the ground there last month. Mortars, RPGs, AKs, and several million rounds of ammunition. And what do you think the Russian president said when we asked him to intervene?
Ivan who?
Words to that effect. It's clear no amount of cajoling or sweet talk is ever going to convince the Kremlin to shut down Ivan's operation. If we ever want to put him out of business, we're going to have to do it ourselves.
As long as Ivan is in Russia, he's untouchable.
That's true, as long as he stays in Russia. But if he were to leave...
He won't leave, Adrian.
Not with an Interpol red notice hanging over his head.
One would think,
but Ivan can be impulsive. Carter bunched his hands beneath his chin and gazed at the walls of the old city.
By our count, you and your team killed 11 Russians in Europe this summer. We were wondering whether you might be interested in going after one more target.
Gabriel felt his heart banging against his ribs. His next words were spoken with far more calm than he was feeling.
Where's he going?
Carter told him.
Isn't he still under indictment there?
Langley is of the opinion the country in question has no real desire to go after him.
Why not?
Politics, of course, and oil. This country wants to improve its ties with Moscow. It believes that arresting and prosecuting a personal friend of the Russian president would only lead to criminal retaliation.
Does the intelligence service of the country in question know Ivan is headed their way?
Given our concerns about their politicians, we've chosen not to inform their spies. Also, it will make other options more difficult to execute.
What other options?
Seems to me we have 3.
Number 1.
Let him enjoy his holiday and forget about it.
Bad idea. Number 2.
Arrest him ourselves and bring him to American soil for trial.
Too messy.
Besides, it would cause a crisis between the United States and an important European ally.
Our thoughts exactly.
In fact, we feel we are precluded from taking any action on the soil of this country.
Carter paused, then added,
which brings us to the 3rd option.
What's that?
Kacho Balaban.
How certain are you that Ivan will be there?
Carter handed over the dossier.
Dead certain.
Chapter 77. Saint-Tropez, France. Appropriately enough, the boat was called Mischief. 178 feet of American-built, Bahamian-registered luxury, owned and operated by one Maxim Simonov, better known as Mad Maxim, king of Russia's lucrative nickel industry, friend and playmate of the Russian president, and former guest at Villa Soleil, Ivan Karkov's now vacant palace by the sea in Saint-Tropez. Though Maxim owned a villa worth $20 million on Spain's Costa del Sol, he preferred the privacy and mobility of his yacht. He'd toured the North African coast in June and had spent July island-hopping through Greece. On the final leg of the excursion, he had ordered his crew to make a brief detour to the Turkish coast. And there, on the morning of August the 9th, he had taken aboard 2 more passengers, a sturdy-looking man called Alexei Budanov and his ravishing young wife, Zoya. Though childless, the couple had vast quantities of luggage, so much, in fact, they required a 2nd stateroom just for storage. Mad Maxim seemed not to mind. His friends had endured a horrible year. And Mad Maxim, a generous soul if ever there was, had taken it upon himself to see they at least had a proper summer holiday. The host had earned his nickname not through his business acumen, but through his leisure activities. His parties were notoriously wild affairs that seldom ended without violence or arrests. Indeed, several years earlier, Maxim was briefly detained after allegedly importing a plane load of Russian prostitutes to entertain guests at his chateau outside Paris. The French police later agreed to drop all charges after the billionaire managed to convince them the girls were simply part of a modern dance troupe. The outrageous but somewhat comical affair did nothing to harm Maxim standing at home. In fact, the Moscow papers hailed him as the perfect example of the new Russian. Mad Maxim had money and he was not afraid to flaunt it, even if it meant getting into a scrape every now and again with the French police. The pace of his partying did not slow at sea. If anything, freed from the constraints of meddlesome authorities and complaining neighbors, it reached new levels of intensity. That summer had already produced many notable evenings of debauchery. but new heights were achieved with the arrival of Alexei and Zoya Budanov. Looked after by a crew of 30, the entourage spent the voyage eating, drinking, and fornicating their way across the Mediterranean, before finally arriving in the fabled old port of Saint-Tropez on the afternoon of August the 20th. Though exhausted and deeply hungover from the previous evening's adventures, the passengers immediately boarded mischief's dinghies and headed for shore. All but the man known as Alexei Budanov, who remained on the aft deck, hands resting on the railing, staring at Saint-Tropez as if it were his forbidden city. And though Mr. Budanov did not know it, he was already being watched by a man standing at the base of the lighthouse at the end of the Quai des Saints d'Or. The man wore khaki shorts, a white pullover, a bucket hat, and wraparound sunglasses. Several months earlier, in a birch forest outside Moscow, Mr. Budanov had tried to kill his wife. Now the man planned to kill Mr. Budanov. But for that, he needed one thing. He needed him to leave the ship. He was confident Mr. Budanov would not stay there long. The Russian was addicted to money, women, and Saint-Tropez. The French resort had been the backdrop for his downfall, and it would be the setting for his death. The man of medium height and build was sure of this. He simply had to be patient. He had to let Mr. Budanov come to him, and then he would put him down. Fortunately, he would not have to wait alone. He had 8 associates to keep him company. Under different names and speaking different languages, they had spent most of the summer on a tour of Europe quite unlike any other. This would be the last stop on their itinerary. Then it would be over. They lived together under one roof, in a villa located in the hills above the city. It had pale blue shutters and a large swimming pool with views of the distant sea. They spent little time in their pool, just enough to deceive the neighbors. Indeed, most of their time was spent on the streets of Saint-Tropez, watching, shadowing, listening. A friend at the CIA made their task easier by sending transcripts and recordings of all telephone calls made from the yacht or by its passengers. The intercepts gave them advance warning whenever Mad Maxime or a member of his party was coming to town. They knew ahead of time where they planned to have lunch each day, where they planned to have dinner, and which exclusive nightclub they planned to wreck sometime after midnight. The intercepts also allowed them to hear the voice of Alexei Budanov himself. Nearly all his calls were to Moscow. Not once did he identify himself or utter his own name. Nor did he set foot off the mischief. Even when the others dined at Le Grand Joseph, his favorite lunch spot, he remained a prisoner of the yacht. And the man of medium height and build passed the time a short distance away, at the foot of his lighthouse. To help fill the empty hours, he dreamed of making love to his wife, and he restored imaginary paintings, and he remembered in vivid detail the nightmare in the birch forest. For the most part, though, he kept his eyes focused on the yacht, and he waited. Always the waiting. Waiting for a plane or train. Waiting for a source. Waiting for the sun to rise after a night of killing. And waiting for Ivan Kharkov to finally make his return to Saint-Tropez. Late in the afternoon of the 29th, while watching mischief's dinghies returning to the mothership, Gabriel received a call on his secure cell phone. The voice he heard was Ilya Levan's.
You'd better get up here right away.
In the end, it was not American technology that would be Yvonne's undoing, but Israeli cunning. While walking along the Chemin de Coquette, a residential street south of Saint-Tropez's bustling Centre-Ville, Levan had noticed a new sign on the door of the restaurant known as Villa Romana. Written in English, French, and Russian, it stated that, regrettably, the famous Saint-Tropez eatery and party spot would be closed 2 nights hence for a private affair. Posing as a paparazzi in search of movie stars, Levan had tossed a bit of money around the waitstaff to see if he could learn the identity of the individual who had booked the establishment. From one despondent bartender, he learned it was going to be an all-Russian affair. A busboy confided it was going to be a blowout. His word, a blowout. And finally, from the stunning hostess, he was able to obtain the name of the man who would be throwing the party and footing the bill. Mad Maxime Simonov, the Nickel King of Russia.
No movie stars, the girl said. Just drunk Russians and their girlfriends. Every year they celebrate the last night of the season. It should be a night to remember.
It would be, Levan thought. A very memorable night indeed. Gabriel placed a wager, one he was confident would pay handsomely. He wagered that Ivan Kharkov could not possibly come all the way to Côte d'Azur and resist the gravitational pull of Villa Romana, a restaurant where he had once had a regular table. He would take reasonable precautions, perhaps even wear a crude disguise of some sort. But he would come, and Gabriel would be waiting. Whether he pulled the trigger would be contingent on two factors. He would shed no innocent blood, other than that of armed bodyguards, and he would not sink to Ivan's level by killing him in front of his young wife. Levon came up with a plan of action. They called it Fun with Phones. It was a night to remember, and just as Gabriel predicted, Ivan was unable to resist attending the party. The techno-pop music was deafening, the women were barely clad, and the champagne flowed like a swollen river. Ivan kept a low profile, though he wore no disguise, since not one of the invited guests would have dared to report his presence. As for the possibility he might have been in any physical danger, this too seemed to have been discounted. The two bodyguards that Mad Maxime had brought along for protection were standing like doormen outside Villa Romana's entrance, and if either one of them so much as twitched, they would die there at 2 a.m. 2 a.m., because Ivan's defenses would be weakened by fatigue and alcohol. 2 a.m., because that is the hour the Chemin du Conquet finally goes quiet on a warm summer night. 2 a.m., because that is when Ivan would receive the telephone call that would draw him into the street, the call that would signal that the end was finally near. For their staging point, Gabriel and Mikhail chose the edge of a small playground at the northern end of the Chemin du Conquet. They did this because they thought it was just, and because the entrance of Villa Romana was only 50 yards away. They sat astride their motorbikes in a dark patch between the street lamps and listened to the voices in their miniature earpieces. No one gave them a second look. Sitting idly on a motorbike at 2 a.m. is what one does on a warm summer night in Saint-Tropez, especially when the first crack of autumn thunder is only days away. It was not thunder that caused them to start their engines, but a quiet voice. It told them the call had just gone through to Yvonne's phone. It told them the time was nearly at hand. Gabriel touched the .45 caliber Glock at the small of his back. The Glock loaded with highly destructive hollow-tipped rounds, and made a slight modification in its position. Then he lowered the visor on his helmet and waited for the signal. It was Oleg Rudenko calling from Moscow. At least, that's what Ivan was led to believe. He couldn't quite be certain. He never would be. The connection was too tenuous, the music too loud. Ivan knew three things. The caller spoke Russian, had the direct number for his mobile, and said it was extremely urgent. That was enough to put him on his feet and send him marching into the quiet of the street, phone to one ear, hand over the other. If Ivan heard the approaching motorbikes, he gave no sign of it. In fact, he was shouting in Russian, his back turned, at the instant Gabriel brought his motorbike to a stop. The bodyguards at the front door immediately sensed trouble and foolishly reached into their blazers. Mikhail shot each through the heart before they managed to touch their weapons. Seeing the guards go down, Ivan whirled around in terror, only to find himself staring down the suppressor at the end of the Glock. Gabriel lifted the visor of his helmet and smiled. Then he pulled the trigger, and Ivan's face vanished. For Grigori, he thought, as he drove off into the darkness. For Chiara. Author's note. The Defector is a work of entertainment. The names, characters, places, and incidents portrayed in this novel are the product of the author's imagination, or have been used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, businesses, companies, events, or locales is entirely coincidental. The Siberian oil giant Rus Oil does not exist, nor does the Moskovskaya Gazeta or Galaxy Travel of Tverskaya Street. Viktor Orlov, Olga Sukova, and Grigori Bolganov are in no way meant to be construed as fictitious renderings of real people. The headquarters of the Israeli Secret Service is no longer located on King Saul Boulevard in Tel Aviv. I have chosen to keep the headquarters of my fictitious service there, in part because I have always liked the name. I have tinkered with airline schedules to make them fit my story. Anyone trying to reach London from Moscow will search in vain for Aeroflot Flight 247. There is no private bank in Zurich called Becker & Poole. Its internal operating procedures were invented by the author. The Office of Presidential Advance has been accurately portrayed, but to the best of my knowledge, it has never been used to provide cover for an Israeli spy. There is no airfield at Konakovo, at least not one that I am aware of, nor is there a division of the FSB known as the Department of Coordination.
A chess club does indeed meet on Tuesday evenings in the lower vestry house of St. George's Church in Bloomsbury. It is called the Greater London Chess Club, not the Central London Chess Club, and its members are charming and gracious to a fault. Deepest apologies to the management of Villa Romana in Saint-Tropez for carrying out an assassination on their doorstep, but I'm afraid it had to be done. Also apologies to the residents of the lovely Bristol Mews in Maida Vale for placing a Russian defector in their midst. Were the author ever to go into hiding in London, it would certainly be there. Readers should not go looking for Gabriel Alon at No. 16 Narcus Street in Jerusalem, or for Victor Orlov at No. 43 Cheney Walk in Chelsea. Nor should they read too much into my use of a poison-dispensing ring, though I suspect the KGB and its successors probably have one. The great terror-killing ground discovered at the climax of the defector is fictitious, but sadly the historical circumstances that could have created such a place are not. Precisely how many people were shot to death during the brutal repressions lasting from 1936 to 1938 may never be known. Estimates range from approximately 700,000 to well over a million. Suffice it to say, the number of those executed is but one measure of the suffering Stalin inflicted on Russia during the time of the Great Terror. Historian Robert Conquest estimates that the purges and Stalin-induced famines probably claimed between 11 million and 13 million lives. Other historians place the number even higher. And still, opinion polls consistently find that Stalin remains highly popular among Russians to this day. One of the few sites where Russians can mourn Stalin's victims is Butovo, just south of Moscow. There, from August 1937 to October 1938, an estimated 20,000 people were shot in the back of the head and buried in long mass graves. I visited the recently opened memorial at Butovo with my family in the summer of 2007 while researching Moscow rules, and in large measure, it inspired the defector. One question haunted me as I walked slowly past the burial trenches, accompanied by weeping Russian citizens. Why are there not more places like this? Places where ordinary Russians can see evidence of Stalin's unimaginable crimes with their own eyes. The answer, of course, is that the rulers of the new Russia are not terribly interested in exposing the sins of the Soviet past. On the contrary, they are engaged in a carefully orchestrated endeavor to airbrush away its most repulsive aspects while celebrating its achievements. One can understand their motives. The NKVD, which carried out the Great Terror at Stalin's behest, was the forerunner of the KGB, and former officers of the KGB, including Vladimir Putin himself, are now running Russia. There is a danger to such historical myopia, of course, the danger that it might happen again. In smaller, far more subtle ways, it already is. Since coming to power in 1999, Vladimir Putin, Russia's former president and now prime minister, has overseen a wide-ranging curtailment of press and civic freedoms. And in December 2008, the government introduced new legislation that would greatly expand the definition of state treason. Human rights activists, already on shaky ground, fear the laws could be used to jail anyone who dares to criticize the regime. Andrei Lubovoy, the former KGB officer accused by British authorities of the November 2006 poisoning of the dissident defector Alexander Litvinenko, apparently feels the new law does not go far enough. Now a member of parliament, and a hero to many Russians, he told the Spanish newspaper El País that anyone who dares to criticize Russia should be exterminated. Lugovoy went on to say, "Do I think someone should have killed Litvinenko in the interests of the Russian state? If you're talking about the interests of the Russian state, in the purest sense of the word, I myself would have given that order." This from the man wanted by British authorities for the very same murder of which he speaks. For those who dare to question the Kremlin and Russia's powerful elite, arrest and prosecution are sometimes the least of their worries. Too many have simply been killed in cold blood. Witness the case of Stanislav Markalev, the crusading human rights lawyer and social justice activist, gunned down on a central Moscow street in January 2009 as he was leaving a news conference. Also killed was Anastasia Baburova, a freelance journalist for Novaya Gazeta, tragically the same publication that employed Anna Politkovskaya, who was shot to death in the elevator of her Moscow apartment house in October 2006. According to the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists, 49 media professionals have been killed in Russia since 1992. Only in Iraq and Algeria have more died in the line of duty during the same period. This, too, is a Russian tragedy. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Defector by Daniel Silva. Copyright 2009 by Daniel Silva. Performed by Phil Giganti. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Corey Young. Performance copyright 2009 Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliantaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be screened, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.